From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The slowdown in the economy has hit individuals, families, companies, and even governments. Faced with budget shortfalls, some state governments are considering choices that will please no one. Cut education or health care or roads or release prisoners early. That's right. At least 8 states, including Rhode Island, New Jersey, and Kentucky, are considering releasing thousands of inmates ahead of schedule in hopes of saving billions of dollars. Joining us today to talk over the politics of early release are Adam Gelb. He's the director of the Public Safety Performance Project at the Pew Center on the States, and Khalid Shaw, director of Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace Foundation. That's a South Los Angeles anti-violence community-based organization. Welcome, gentlemen.
Greetings.
Hello.
So, Adam, the Pew Center recently did a report highlighting the huge prison population in the U.S., 1 in 100 adults in jail or prison. So how much of a strain does housing almost 1.4 million prisoners have on the state budgets?
It's put a tremendous strain for over the past 20 years, we've seen an increase of about 1 million people behind bars. 20 years ago, there were about 600,000. Now it's 1.6 million. And the budget's gone up about twice as fast as the number of inmates and has really started to crowd out spending on other priorities, education and health care, and particularly higher education, which is something we hear about frequently.
So if you take into account some of these potential early release programs, what kind of budget cuts or budget savings are states trying to achieve?
Well, there really is a gamut there. I mean, some states like California, where they're looking to release over 20,000 inmates, would achieve a sizable savings. Other states, smaller states like Rhode Island, are talking about much smaller numbers. The important thing here to realize, though, is that early release is a bit of a misleading term. And the fact is, if you look over sort of a 2-year or 3-year period, these folks are getting out. They're coming out, despite all of that building that we have done over the past 20 years. More than 97% of these guys get out, and that is the few who do stay in, the lifers, those with very long sentences who committed violent crimes or serious chronic criminals. That's not who any of these states are likely to be releasing. They realize that wouldn't make sense for public safety or politically otherwise. So if you look at a 2 or 3 year stretch of time, all these folks will be getting out anyway. The question becomes whether or not there's really any impact on public safety to let somebody out 90 days earlier. And it does certainly have some implications for who gets victimized and where. That can be very tough when you can see a situation where a crime has occurred that wouldn't have occurred if this person had been behind bars. But lots of studies have been done over this over the years, and there's just no evidence to show that the crime rate overall is impacted by people getting out a number of days or weeks earlier than they otherwise were scheduled to do so.
So, Khalid, you are really grassroots on the ground dealing with a community that, like many, just has to face the fact that violent crime is much higher than it wants. So when you think about your portion of Los Angeles and the folks that are in your service area, are people concerned about early release, or are they just concerned in general about what happens to prisoners when they get released?
Well, first I'd like to say that I also chair the Regional Violence Prevention Coalition. We cover San Bernardino, Riverside, Los Angeles counties, work with over 100 agencies in those areas. But in answer to your question, yes, people are concerned, and I think the response to that is predictable. When you talk about violence and crime, and the 6 o'clock news is usually a horror show for most folks in the community, and you're talking about letting 2,000 felons out on the street, predictably people are going to be concerned. But I'd just like to echo what was just said about the reality. These people are going to be released anyway, and I think the larger critical question as it relates to this piece is, what have we done as a society to make sure that when they're released, they're able to transition, become productive members of society? And I think that's the bigger question.
Well, along those lines, tomorrow the president is expected to sign into law the Second Chance Act, and it would provide $362 million for prisoner reentry services, including drug treatment, education, job training. Is that the kind of substantial investment you're looking for?
You know, it's interesting that you stated that. You know, we just here in the state of California signed a bill that is for $7.4 billion to build new prisons here in California. $300 million of that is the interest on that money. So, you know, as we talk about solutions, yeah, it's a step in the right direction. But at the end of the day, a little too late, you know, I think we need to start looking at having some real discussions around really looking at changing the systemic issues that get people involved in violence and crime, et cetera.
Adam, along those lines, Pew does a lot of research about where America is and where America is headed. And so when you look at this from a policy perspective, where do you think we should try to take this conversation over not just early release, but also over reentry in general?
Well, the conversation has really moved a tremendous distance over the past 5 years or so. And the notion that the President of the United States will sign a bill called the Second Chance Act tomorrow in itself is an incredible symbol of this. I mean, you have folks like Senator Sam Brownback, a very conservative senator from Kansas, along with representatives from represent inner city districts in Chicago and other cities around the country, coming together around a bill that essentially says we recognize that large numbers of offenders are coming back to our communities. We have not built our way out of the crime problem with additional prisons, and we need to do everything we can to help these people succeed when they come back to the communities, both for our own interests and the community's broader interest, as well as the offenders' interests themselves. And it is really quite an astonishing thing, and we're seeing that not just at the federal level. In fact, the federal level is a little bit behind some of the states on this. As you're probably aware, Texas, this past legislative session in 2007, passed a significant measure. They said no to as many as 8 new prisons and decided instead to build out a network of residential treatment centers for low-level offenders with drug problems. Kansas, again, passed a grant program to the counties to say, we don't want you to send these probation violators to our prisons and take up an expensive prison cell with folks who've broken the rules but not committed new crimes. Nevada has said if inmates complete programs behind the walls that are designed to reduce recidivism, like substance abuse and vocational literacy programs, that they can shave a little bit of time off their sentences. So
we're seeing
the country, we're seeing that kind of consensus develop across political lines that this is an issue that's got to be dealt with a different way.
But Khalid, when you talk about the day-to-day right now,
right,
you know, before there are any new big changes, what are folks wanting on a community level when you have to make do with the systems that are in place now? What kinds of responses do you think people that you are dealing with would like to see?
Well, you know, just like everybody, folks just want to be safe. They want to feel safe in their communities. But I think the issues that we're dealing with are critically important because one of the things that has not happened as we talk about criminal justice system is the real stakeholders have not had a chance to get involved in the conversation around criminal justice, building prisons, and what we need to do to keep our young folks out of prison. I mean, it's deplorable to see that we've just passed the bill to build new prisons here in the state of California, and school teachers are being laid off as we speak. Medical centers are being closed down. The poor are being affected in a way that is just deplorable. So at the end of the day, I think that a conversation, more conversation needs to take place with real stakeholders. And when I say real stakeholders, I'm talking about folk in the community who live in those communities, sitting down with law enforcement, sitting down with folk who make policy, sitting down with the powers that be to frame the what the next step should look like as it relates to our criminal justice system. I think they need to be a part of that discussion, and that discussion doesn't need to be a political discussion. It needs to be a community discussion.
When you think about, and if you can, keep this brief, because I want to get both of you in before we wrap up. But, Khalid, when you think about this whole idea of the stakeholders, you're talking about real people who probably, like most of us, have someone connected to them who has been through the criminal justice system in some form. And how can we retain a certain amount of, I guess, compassion for people who are offenders but still make smart choices overall?
I think the way that's done is, you know, there's examples taking place in communities all around the country now. And I'm talking about building collaborations that include all of those stakeholders. When you have epidemiologists and you have law enforcement and you have real community stakeholders at the table.
Adam, just very quickly, who do you think needs to come to the table?
Well, I think Khalid just gave a good answer there. But in addition to that, and it need to be police, need to be victims, need to be prosecutors, need to be judges, the people at the front end of the criminal justice system.
Yes.
There are broad social and economic factors that have led in part to the United States crime rates and to how many people we have in prison. But fundamentally, the reason the population is as large as it is state policy decisions about who's going to prison and for how long. And so there are conversations that can be had at the policy level and are being had in places like Texas and Kansas and Nevada, as I mentioned, that are having a significant impact on the number of people behind the walls and on the level of community.
All right. Well, Adam and Khalid, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Adam Gelb is director of the Public Safety Performance Project at the Pew Center on the States, and Khalid Shaw is the director of the Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace Foundation. He joined us from our studios at NPR West. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've just heard how at least 8 states are thinking about expanding early prison release programs. They're trying to save money in the cash-strapped times that we live in. But life on the other side can be tough on former prisoners. They struggle to get jobs, housing, and health care. Things are even more complicated if their crimes were sexual or violent. So what will more prisoners leaving prison sooner mean for already meager reentry and rehabilitation resources? For 2 views on this, I'm joined by Melissa Bradley. She's president of the Reentry Strategies Institute of Washington, D.C. The nonprofit agency designs, supports, and advocates for effective and affordable reentry programs for prisoners. Also with me is Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Also with me is Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Jason and Melissa, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Melissa. You work with lots of different agencies, public and private. What kinds of resources do you already see that are out there to help with people transitioning to life on the outside?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that there are numerous services that have been designed over many years, many starting back in the early 90s when structured sentencing changed, that are designed specifically to help with reentry. The problem is oftentimes a disconnect between the Department of Corrections and the community-based organizations who are providing these services. So the challenge you see right now is that governments are facing budget cuts, but there are numerous organizations they could be partnering with and reinvesting those dollars to provide reentry support.
Who exactly, Melissa, is responsible for this? I mean, you know, obviously, up until the point when someone leaves the prison doors, there's got to be a state entity that's responsible. Although there are private companies that also run prisons, they're all contracted through, you know, a city, state, or federal government. Once people walk through those doors, who's responsible?
Well, I think it depends on your perspective. I mean, if you look at how they got in, one would say that oftentimes it's the challenges faced in the community, lack of employment, lack of family support, lack of health care, that has actually caused many of them to enter those doors. So one could say the community and its infrastructure has failed. Once they enter those doors, clearly the whole goal of Department of Corrections is supervision, and so they're responsible for them. The missing link is the reentry, recognizing that over 90% of all people going into prison are going to get out at some point in time. The missing link is the ability to help prisoners as they enter begin to even prepare to get out the door.
Jason, we've spoken with you before on the show, and you've given us a perspective on how you really can create an environment where people are working together, invested in making a transition from sometimes the illegal economy to the legal economy. What do you find works best? You know, what are some of the things that make your program work?
Well, we understand that each offender is unique in their own right. No two are alike. There may be similarities, but there is no rhyme or reason to what will work or what won't work, because each offender is released with their own specific issues. For instance, someone who has been convicted for assault, like Melissa stated, may not be assertive in their job search because their victim may be seeking revenge. We tend to forget about the unresolved issues that offenders, you know, leave behind when they are incarcerated. So it's like we just meet each individual on their own terms. We don't try and use a one-size-fits-all model.
Now, when you say that someone might be, just explain a little bit about what you meant. If someone might not be assertive in their job search because the person they assaulted is seeking revenge, do you mean in a gang-related kind of way, or what are you talking about?
It can be in a gang-related way, but it also can be like if someone was convicted for a robbery, and there was a victim in the home at the time of the robbery, somebody may want to get personal revenge or seek some kind of personal justice on the individual. I mean, it's like some people, for instance, someone who's convicted of a sexual crime, they may want to get some kind of revenge for the assault of their daughter or for their mother or their niece or something like that. So they may not be as assertive looking for jobs because they fear that there's going to be some kind of reprisal while they're out in the community.
You know, before I go back to the specifics of, you know, what agencies do for reentry, Jason, when you counsel someone who might have done a terrible wrong and finds that they are in a position where they might be facing reprisal, how do you counsel them to lead their life, knowing that they committed the crime, but also knowing that they might face vigilante justice?
I just tell them to do what they feel is needed in their gut. I can't give them any kind of personal counsel because I don't really ask them about their crimes. I just ask them, how can I help them? I don't, you know, indulge in what happened and what made them do it and things like that. I just try and help them where they are. They offer the information that they want to give me, and I just go from that and let them know what happened with me and my personal journey through reentry. So I never, you know, really go into depth about the crime they committed or why they did what they did. So we just go from where they're at and move forward.
Melissa, you know, Jason raises some complicated questions, which is that people, all of us, are in this world with baggage that we have accumulated over time. But if you've committed a crime, if you're incarcerated, you have some direct ties to this question of responsibility, retribution, repentance, those big concepts that drive us on a moral level. So give me a perspective on what programs do and don't offer, you know, in terms of whether some of them are strictly like job placement, some of them are really dealing with the you know, the broader issues, emotional and social issues. How do these things play out across programs?
Well, I think there's two types of programs. You'll find there are comprehensive programs, and then there are specific, you know, subject area programs. So there are programs that just focus on job placement, and you can walk into the door, you can say, I need a job, and they actually act like a temp agency and try and find you a job. They may or may not address some of the other issues you may have in terms of just knowing how to be on time, knowing how to use the bus system. And then you have comprehensive programs, which oftentimes have a very stringent intake process to really assess what are your health care needs, what are your family support needs, what are your employment needs, and they then work with you to get, you know, possibly vocational rehabilitation. They work with you to have counseling with your family. They may even work with you to be in a drug treatment program, or recognizing the significant amount of folks, 1 in 6, in fact, who are mentally ill, they may just begin to provide you with some medical treatment that you may need.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about some of the dire graduation rates in America's urban centers, particularly for young black men and women. Do you think that this has an impact on who gets in and then once they get out, how they live their lives?
I think it definitely has an impact. I mean, again, I don't think we can be naive. We must recognize, while I certainly am a strong proponent of individual responsibility, we must recognize that the system is broken and that when you look at urban communities where a majority of folks are coming out of their communities and going into prison, the challenges and the lack of scaffolding and support that exists is oftentimes an impetus or a catalyst for them to enter into the world of crime. And so it's not going to be any different for folks who, you know, who necessarily have gone to college. If you come back and there's no support, there's no support. We also must not be naive. There is an element of structural racism here that has certainly played into the fact that there are higher numbers of African-American males who are just disenfranchised, period, whether they can't get a job or they may find themselves in prison.
In case you are just tuning in, we are talking about reentry from prison with Melissa Bradley. She's president of the Reentry Strategies Institute of Washington, D.C. Also, Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Jason, when you listen to Melissa talk about these issues of structural inequality, you know, do you even approach some of those issues when you talk to the young men in your program, or is it more like, is it more on the practical side? Look, this is what you need to do to get a job. What's the structure of your program?
I definitely give them both sides. It's needed. Like, structural racism is there, but there has to be a personal commitment to overcome. You can't just totally depend on the system. That system was broken, like Melissa stated before, and more than likely it's going to be broken when you try and enter back into it. So there has to be some level of perseverance on the individual in order for them to overcome. So I give them both sides. I let them know, like, hey, we haven't evolved enough to say that racism doesn't exist. I mean, it's there and you have to deal with it and you have to meet it on its terms, but you have to be ready to handle that conflict when it arises, and you can't get off of your square because it is there. So I give them both. I give them both sides. I mean, I try and give them everything they need. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything when I'm talking to them, because they see things, you know, a lot. Some of them are mentally impaired, but most of them do understand that something isn't right, but they just don't know how to channel their energy into doing what is right.
Now, you talk about how you speak to the gentleman in your program from your own personal experience, and you spent 20 months in prison on 3 felony convictions. When you came home, how motivated were you, or how able were you to jump right back into the saddle and try to get your life right?
I was extremely motivated. I went in as a different kind of individual. Most people don't go into the system with a high school diploma. You know, I graduated from high school, and most people that are incarcerated are seeking their GED, or some may be going for college classes, but most don't have a high school diploma. So I went in with a little bit of education, and I had guidance early in life. I really couldn't accept it because it was coming from my mother, who was trying to raise me to be a man, and I just couldn't hear the message. But I had some good values that were instilled in me. So when I was released, I was ready to hit the ground running. And that's what I did. I got back in college, and, you know, I'll be finished with my master's in the fall. And I knew that higher education would take me to the level of success that I really was trying to obtain, because I was a drug dealer. So I obtained instant gratification. So going through college and taking those steps to improve myself and improve the ability of helping someone else actually made me just ready to do all the things that I'm actually doing now. So when I got out on work release, which was 6 months, I knew that I was going to get a job, and I got a job in 5 days. And then I became supervisor, and I, you know, constantly elevated myself. But I knew when they opened them doors for me that I was going to do some things that most people are not doing, and that's have a successful reentry.
Melissa, when you look at these broad array of programs, there's the federal level, and in 2004, President Bush announced a prisoner reentry initiative. It was dealing with about 30 faith-based and community institutions that received grants totaling about $25 million. Do you have any sense of whether this has had an impact, you know, symbolically or in real terms in changing people's lives? I mean, we haven't heard much about it since it was announced.
Well, I think symbolically it made a difference. I mean, you certainly the day after, I think you could not pick up a paper or have a conversation at the water cooler. People were not talking about reentry. I think it scratched the surface and in some cases allowed people to start talking about the fact that at least somebody in somebody else's family has been in the system. So I think symbolically it was important. I think the numbers, however, speak for themselves. It was an initiative that was $25 million. However, we spent over $100 million a day just on supervision. So when you look at PRI, when you look at the Second Chance Act that's going to authorize possibly about $400 million, there's still an extreme inequity in terms of how much money we're putting toward the problem. When economics allow greater opportunity, greater jobs be created through incarceration, and we don't balance that for reentry, it's a real challenge. So I would say at the end, it's been symbolic. We haven't really seen the results yet. You still find many groups struggling to be able to find and maybe it'll make ends meet.
If you had to, you know, if you had unlimited resources, Melissa, what would you do in terms of reentry, in terms of creating a path for people to succeed once they get out of jail or prison?
Well, what a wonderful problem that would be. I think there's a couple of strategies to take. One is to begin to funnel some money just into community and economic development, to begin to look at communities and the structures that exist or don't exist that will begin to have some prevention programs that are actually effective, looking at unemployment rates, looking at access to health care, looking at family support. So that's the first strategy. I think the second strategy is recognizing that people are going to make mistakes, but being willing to look at alternatives to incarceration. There are many programs in New York and San Francisco that have had outstanding results by looking at other options, whether it be reentry courts, community service, employment, counseling or monitoring, that have actually diverted people from going to prison where indeed it's not a positive experience and in many cases changes people's lives and makes them even worse and puts them in a very different state of mind where they're hopeless and struggle to get out. And then I think the third piece is recognize that some people do have to go to prison, but eventually they are going to get out. And begin to really support comprehensive programs. I think that Jason said it best. No one is the same. And so you must have programs that can afford to offer individualized attention and support so that people can indeed be successful.
Jason, I throw the same question at you with a particular focus on what kind of got us started in the first place, this whole question of early release. No matter when people are released, they can have different reactions to being released, whether it's a positive one like you who said, I'm going to hit the ground running, or someone who's bitter or someone who's fearful. So knowing that given the financial issues in America today, some prisoners might be released ahead of schedule, some will serve out their full sentences. What would you do with an unlimited amount of money to really try to address this problem?
Well, I would definitely put it in a housing and jobs first and foremost, because most people don't want to hire someone with felony convictions. You know, they're judging people by the worst thing that they've done. They're not looking at the individual. They're looking at what's on the paper. So I would definitely have some job placement. We struggle each day trying to find jobs for people and housing. They don't want someone who has a felony conviction. They think you did a crime. You're going to always do that specific crime. So definitely in the housing and jobs, and also, like Melissa stated, there has to be some individual one-on-one help. It's not really in the form of hand-holding, but actually sitting them down and say, hey, you can have a bright future if you do 1, 2, and 3. You have to talk to them just for where they are. And with housing and jobs and then putting all the other pieces together, ex-offender can get a sense of accomplishment and start feeling better about themselves and actually do the things that they need to do. So an early release could be good for some, but harmful for others, depending on the individual. If an individual has a structure already in place of community support and accountability, not just through the Department of Corrections or through agencies that have to supervise them, they can actually see their future and actually know that people are with them, ready to, you know, help them take the next steps.
Well, Jason, Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Soul is a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. He joined us from Audio Ruckus in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Melissa Bradley is president of the Reentry Strategies Institute in Washington, D.C. She joined us from NPR's headquarters studios in Washington. Baby, come touch me. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes on Africa Update. It's been over a week since the elections in Zimbabwe and still no results. But one thing seems clear. The current president, Robert Mugabe, is going to fight to stay in power. Plus, relief agencies say fighting in Somalia is the worst in 15 years. For more, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She's director of Africa Policy for TransAfrica Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. And, you know, what's the latest that you're hearing from people on the ground in Zimbabwe?
The latest that we're hearing is that things are slowly disintegrating. It's quite unfortunate, actually. There's about 21 days until the runoff election, and in the last 4 days, we've seen the government step up its measures to really, to across the board, engage in political intimidation from groups of armed or unarmed militia who are going house to house in certain parts of the country trying to intimidate people from voting and coming out and voting against ZANU-PF in the next election, to the arrest and detainment of more international and Zimbabwean journalists. And so we see that things are really just fastly escalating, and the response from the international community has not been enough.
Speaking of the response from the international community, the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai just flew to South Africa seeking help with the stalemate. But the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, told reporters it's time to wait when asked if the international community should respond. So why do you think that Mbeki has chosen that path?
I think that Mbeki really is very, very politically astute and sees the danger, actually, of intervening in Zimbabwe. I mean, if you think about the routes that they have in front of them, there are already secret talks going on between, not-so-secret talks, between ZANU-PF and MDC. The only other kind of intervention that South Africa could actually do at this point was to put troops on the ground, and that would be disastrous for Zimbabweans and for South Africans. But it's been interesting also that he sees the way in which Morgan Tsvangirai is actually positioning himself with Jacob Zuma, who he met with when he was in South Africa, and how that actually creates even more political tensions both in South Africa and in the region.
Now, Jacob Zuma is the deputy who will take the mantle most likely in South Africa. So it sounds like there's a little bit of triangulation going on there.
Most definitely. I think that we've seen historically that Thabo Mbeki has been quite respectful of the history and legacy of Robert Mugabe and been, for that reason and for other political reasons, really hesitant to intervene. Jacob Zuma, who is much more comfortable, I think, with the MDC-like politics and understanding of the people who are actually supporting MDC both in Zimbabwe and internationally, may be a different kind of player. Although it's too soon to tell, I think some of the issues that Mugabe has taken around land reform and other issues are ones in which South Africa is really, really loath to go that same route, but has its own internal problems.
Yesterday, seven election officials in Zimbabwe were arrested, accused of undercounting votes for Mugabe. And when you look at the big picture here of Zimbabwean elections, what lessons can be learned, you know, for the international community, for election observers, and for people who are in African nations or other nations who want free and fair elections? What kind of lessons can we begin to draw from what's happened so far?
I think there are myriad lessons. I mean, we've seen with the arrest of election officials that elections are tenuous at best. And even with the SADC process that led up to these elections, SADC as a region and the presidents of SADC were not actually able to impose the negotiations that had gone on. And so we saw right before the elections the unraveling of all of the work that had been done over the last year since the March 11th crackdown on MDC. I think for the U.S., for international community, we really need to be looking at the ways in which, because of the ways in which African governments are shaped, mostly in this post-colonial legacy, they're very much shaped the way in which colonial and structured the way that colonial governments were structured, that it places way too much power within the hands of one leader. And that when things like elections happen, it's quite easy for the supreme leader of a country like Zimbabwe and other countries as well to run, for lack of a better word, roughshod over the entire process. I think that also we see that even when you have opening of space for civil society participation, this election, unlike the last presidential election, had greater space for civil society, for media to talk about, to election, to campaign, to critique the government. But all of that has made no difference at all when it comes down to actually counting votes in a fair and accurate way and actually having a president in a free and fair election.
Well, of course, we'll keep our eye on that, but I want to move to Somalia. Last week, two UN contract workers were kidnapped, and there are currently 30 yacht crew members, mostly French, being held hostage by pirates. Now, when you talk about things like that, which sound, you know, baffling on one level, what is going on with the people in Somalia during this time of unrest?
The people in Somalia are suffering in a tremendous way. Actually, last month, the International Red Cross said that the fighting in Somalia that's going on now is the worst in 15 years. The government, the transitional government that was put into power with the help of U.S. and Ethiopian invasion about 15 months ago, has control of nearly none of the country. They control a small part of Mogadishu. The rest of the country is literally falling apart around it. There is also actually, in the last month alone, 40,000 people have fled the capital. These are urban dwellers who are now literally camped out at roadsides trying to get to UN-staffed displacement camps, but really are relying on international community for their most basic needs. It's a really, really dire situation for the people of Somalia.
What's going to happen with some of these relief organizations? Will they be able to continue to operate in this climate?
We've seen over the last 12 months that a couple of things have happened. Several relief organizations have actually pulled out of the country. Organizations like Oxfam, World Vision, organizations that usually are, in times of crisis, the best and most trained to do this kind of work. They have, because they're worried for the safety of their staff, pulled out. And then other organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières, who has stayed in the country but has closed a couple of its operating posts because of this, the safety of their workers just cannot be protected. We see now with the UN is not in a position to pull out, but that this latest kidnapping is actually going to have to change the way in which the UN does its work. You see the increasing use of contractors because there's more leverage with contractors than there is with actually UN staff when people are kidnapped. And what's happening is that this kidnapping is, from what we can tell, not really politically motivated. It's motivated by survival, and so the need for money, for ransom money. And so it's really just a very, very tenuous situation on the ground there.
Let's talk briefly about the Olympics and China. There is the traveling torch. There were protests in San Francisco. A huge banner unfurled on the Golden Gate Bridge yesterday, a Free Tibet banner. But there have also been a lot of protests around Darfur. China is under criticism for its involvement in funding the government and, you know, basically taking the oil revenues, you know, offering oil revenues and buying the oil from this, you know, very troubled country. So do you think that this moment of the Olympic torch being sort of trailed by protesters all around the world will be a chance for people to get a little bit more knowledge about what's going on in Darfur? Will it make a difference?
I think that it might. I think it's definitely making a difference with the Chinese government. China is increasingly concerned about its international image. And so despite the fact that it looks as if they're kind of turning a blind eye to all of the protests around myriad issues, they're really very politically astute and very much watching this. I think also that it will in the U.S., turn some attention toward Darfur. Although, by and large, I think the role of China in Darfur has changed over the last couple of years. And also the role of the U.S. is something that's actually completely absent from this critique. Of China and the U.S. and the U.S.'s inability to act, I think, is one of the main things that people in the U.S. should be concerned about.
Quickly, before we let you go, former presidential candidate Bill Richardson said he believes an all-out U.S. boycott should happen of the Games if China doesn't take a more active role in ending the conflict in Darfur. Is that kind of an approach helpful?
I think that it's actually not helpful. If you look at the history of the Olympic Games and boycotts that have been successful, there actually are none. I think that there are other routes to take. I think also the backlash from boycotts of the Olympics, from U.S. citizens who support the Olympic Games, from athletes from across the globe, is just really too great to bear. I think if a number of countries were to pull out, that might be something slightly different. But I think it's actually too late for that now, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think that there are other routes, and that the U.S. government needs to really go to the U.N. and actually have good faith negotiations around ending the crisis in Darfur. And that means appropriating money, supporting the African Union and their forces there, helping to mediate. I mean, we have normalized relationships with the government in Khartoum, and
Roxanne,
we can use that.
Roxanne, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum and joined us at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. They call him the voice of the Congo. His name is Chico Mwatu, and through his music, he's working hard to bring attention to his homeland, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and to its people devastated by war. He just put out a new CD called Kimbanda Nzila. The profits from its sale will help raise money to build wells for the people in the country formerly known as Zaire. Chico, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
How's the Congo doing right now in terms of day-to-day life? When you talk to your family, your friends, how are things going?
Not so well. We were expecting to have a peace completely after the election, but we still have a few problems here and there as far as human rights is concerned. And there is also killings in some parts of the country, in the West, also in East. So that's not good.
There are a lot of people who've used music to raise awareness about what's going on in different parts of the world. Why do you think people relate to music as a way of understanding and humanizing other people? What is it about music that's so special?
Music is very natural. We are born, our mothers sing for us. The community welcomes you with music, with singing. So it becomes part of your being, of your nature. At the same time, when you cry, it's also like singing. So it seems like singing and music is inside of human being. So when we sing, we cry, we shout, we just bring it outside. So it's very natural.
And your family had a musical tradition. What was it like growing up?
Oh, it was wonderful. My father used to play the accordion, and my brothers used to sing as well. So growing up with them, I learned a lot. It was not difficult for me to become a musician. I just had to create my own identity. That was the hard part.
C'est mon appartient courageux. IMAP Production. Le prix d'Alton au Panda.
Bienvenue à la salle de Colombo, la société de papa maman.
Some people call your sound Congo Rumba. What does that phrase mean to you, and what kind of flavors do you try to put in your music?
Rumba is an old form of music that requires two people to come together and dance. It originated way back in our traditional music. Of course, the name sounds familiar because of Cuba. You know, Cuba is a very strong African tradition, so they play that kind of music as well. So when it came back to us in Africa, especially in Congo, it was welcome back home. So it's a very old type of music. It's about love. It's about one and a partner. So I like to sing for lovers. I like to sing for peace. I like to sing for people can dance, two people.
Hello, Jay, Papa. Oyebike naza omega na lela yo fu. Oyebike basi mosusu bazwa chance ya kuzwa mumbai lokwa yote.
You're donating a percentage of the sales from the CD to the Dikembe Mutombo Foundation. And we spoke with Dikembe last year on the show. He's, just to remind folks, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, plays for the NBA. How did you connect with his foundation?
As you know, he recently opened the hospital in Kinshasa in Democratic Republic of Congo. I wanted to help with my small donations, so I decided to talk to the foundation and make sure that some proceeds go to them so they can help maintain the hospital. And it's a move that is also inviting other Africans and other people of good will to come and help Mutombo.
We do a segment on our show called Africa Update. So every week we do 17 minutes of coverage at a very minimum on the continent of Africa. We talk about different regions at different times. And one of the questions that constantly comes up in America is, why hasn't Africa gone further? Why hasn't there been more development? Why don't leaders do a better job? What do you think people in a position like yours, in a position to use some leverage or some influence or raise some money, what do people need to do for their individual countries and for the continent?
I think it's just help. I think people should just go to the real leaders, people who are helping, who are not involved in politics, because politics in Africa can be very complicated. You see people like Mutombo Dikembe helping Congo the way he's doing. He's not, Mutombo is not involved in politics. He has no interest of becoming a prime minister or president. So he wants to help. So people like him, which I believe there are a lot of them out there, you know, and people like Oprah, for instance, you know, people like that. I mean, they need help, you know, $100, $1,000, maybe $20, you know, it can help people. And people in Africa are human beings just like you and others. So they feel the pain. They are suffering every day. So, you know, here I am doing music. I'm not rich. You know, I am not rich. But I want to share a little bit of what I have with the ones that we left behind.
What do you want to be your legacy in the world of music? Because there's the philanthropy you're doing, but then there's also the music that you're doing. What do you plan to do in the future?
I want to be able to play music that will please Americans. And I want to be able to make them see just the beauty of music, not just African music, but just the beauty of music. That's my goal, to make people happy, to make them dance.
Well, Chico, I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Congolese musician Chico Muwatu, his new CD is Kimbanda Nzila.